And we return. It is today's Topical Currents Monday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. This hour we visit with economist, journalist, and broadcaster Tim Harford. He's a senior columnist at the Financial Times. And as the British say, he's a presenter of BBC Radio 4's More or Less, and also the program Pop-Up Ideas. He's appeared on the Colbert Report, as well as Morning Edition and Marketplace. And he joins us now from Oxford, England. Welcome to you, sir. Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you very much. Or should I say happy lunchtime? Good afternoon.
Either way. So I just want to mention your book. You had written The Undercover Economist. Now you've written The Undercover Economist Strikes Back, How to Run or Ruin an Economy.
I have indeed. I wanted to write a sequel to the first book, and I thought, what's the best sequel ever written? Or the best sequel ever made had Strikes Back at the end of it, didn't it?
Empire.
The Empire.
Exactly. So I thought I'd just poach that phrase.
Well, why don't we begin? You say you're naturally a microeconomist and have always been suspicious of macroeconomies. So why don't we begin with the basics? Define each of them and explain how they differ, if you would.
Sure. Well, the best definition comes from P.J. O'Rourke. He said that microeconomics is the stuff that economists are wrong about specifically, and macroeconomics is the stuff that economists are wrong about in general. So microeconomics is... you go into a Walmart, you go into a Starbucks, and they're pricing in a particular way. And why do they price in that way? And what are they trying to do? And how are they trying to make money out of you? The behavior of individual consumers, how we choose and what we choose. Macroeconomics, which is what this new book is really about the kind of stuff we naturally associate with economics. So unemployment, inflation, arguments over the stimulus, the sort of stuff we haven't been able to get away from for the past 5 or 6 years. And I just felt I couldn't really call myself an economist and sit and watch this financial crisis and recession and so on just rolling on and on and on and not have something to say about it. So hence the new book.
We hear of Keynesian theory being bandied about quite a bit, even though he died in the 1930s, I think. But could you give us a thumbnail of what his theories are comprised of?
Yeah, it is possibly a flaw in economics that we're still referring to theories by the name of their inventor. You know, we don't usually talk about Einsteinian physics. We just talk about physics, but we're still talking about Marxist economics and Keynesian economics and so on. So Keynes was an English economist. He died in 1946, just after the Second World War, and he's really the inventor of macroeconomics, which is the idea that the economy as a whole is something different to the sum of the parts. That even if you understand how all the individual markets work in an economy, there might be something that could go wrong with the economic system as a whole. And today he's most associated with the idea that in a deep recession, the government can do something to help by cutting taxes or by spending money. Although there are a lot of other things that he also believed, but that's become the poster child for what Keynesian thinking is in the modern world.
Well, you distinguish between that and classical types of recession. So how do they differ? And you use examples in your book of the POW camp and the babysitting co-op. So how do they differ?
Well, what I was trying to do there was, economics is a system, macroeconomics is a system, and so the challenge is, how do you show the whole system working? With microeconomics, it's easy to point to a particular thing, like a particular weird pricing strategy or a particular thing that happens in the world and say, that's a great example of this economic idea. But with macroeconomics, you're trying to talk about the system as a whole. And so what I wanted to do was to find very simple economies. You could describe the entire economy and show how it worked. And there's one very famous example of a recession that took place in a babysitting co-op in Washington, D.C. And this isn't a hypothetical example. This really happened in the late 1970s. And the New York Times columnist Paul Krugman has talked about this example a lot because it was very much a Keynesian recession. And what that means is there was an internal flaw in the way that economy worked. The prices didn't adjust. There was a problem with the supply of babysitting tokens. And because of that, that economy broke down. And it needed a kind of intervention, a government intervention from the babysitting co-op committee to get it started again. And that's very much a Keynesian sort of recession. Now, the other example that I give in the book, which is less famous, is, and again, this is a real example, it's not a hypothetical, there was a recession in a prisoner of war camp during the Second World War, and there was an economist there called Robert Radford who witnessed it and who later wrote it up in a learned journal. And the problem in the prisoner of war camp, there was nothing wrong with the way that that economic system worked. Prices adjusted, markets were incredibly efficient. These prisoners had futures markets for bread, and they had futures markets for cigarettes, and very sophisticated. They even exported coffee out of the prisoner of war camp into wartime Germany because there was money to be made exporting the coffee that came into the prisoner of war camp. But the problem is, this POW camp was completely dependent on supplies from the International Red Cross. The Red Cross mailed parcels in with food and cigarettes, and as the war went on, those parcels started to dry up, and they couldn't get through anymore. And so these prisoners were starving, and so you had this terrible situation despite the fact that the economy worked really well. And that is a classical recession. So in that Keynesian recession, it was all about internal flaws in the economy that had to be fixed by the government. In the classical recession, an economy goes into recession because of something outside the economy itself. So maybe it's the Red Cross food parcels, or maybe it's oil prices, or maybe it's a change in the trade regime with China. But whatever it is, it's not something that can easily be fixed by government intervention. And so the argument that we've been having between economists for years now has been, was the financial crisis really Keynesian in its nature, in which case government can step in and help, or was it basically a classical recession? The banks went bankrupt, that damaged the economy, there's nothing we can do about it, and we just have to wait for things to get better. That's the big argument. That's what they're really arguing. Is the real economy, the American economy today, more like that babysitting co-op, or is it more like the prisoner of war camp?
And which is it?
Well, I try to describe in the book the reasons why you might think either is true. I'm not a political guy. I'm not a partisan person. I really want people who read the book, first of all, to say, hey, this is really interesting, actually, but also to be able to make their own decisions. But if you ask me to call it, I would say that the Keynesian view is usually not a helpful way to think about recessions. But in the most recent recession, it was so severe that the Keynesian view was the right way to think about things. And the people who were arguing for more government spending, for tax cuts, and for stimulus spending, they were on the right side of the argument. But I can see why other people disagree. And so I'm trying to give people who read the book the tools to make their own decisions about that.
I might add that the book it's not written by an egghead. It's very readable. In fact, it's in a dialogue form, and it's simple enough that even I think I understood some of it.
Well, you're very kind. The idea was to get people to imagine that they were running the economy. Imagine they had Janet Yellen's job; they'd just taken over the Federal Reserve, or imagine they were running the U.S. Treasury, or maybe the World Bank, or one of these great institutions. Well, what would you do? Which levers could you pull or push, and what difference would that make to the way the economy worked? And so you have this dialogue between the reader, who's in charge, and between the economic advisor, who's me, who's kind of whispering in the reader's ear, saying you could do this, you could do that. But it also gives the reader the opportunity to bite back and say, these economic theories don't make any sense to me, or you're sitting on the fence, or get to the point. So there's the opportunity for a bit of give and take there.
Could today's unemployment be tempered by public works projects such as the WPA and the CCC during the Roosevelt years?
Well, I think that we a little, but we've left it too long for that. The time for that would have been 2008, 2009. And so where I think we need to focus our attention now is the long-term unemployed. There's some very worrying research that I report in the book that shows that this was by an economist who was just mailing out fake resumes. And some of these, thousands and thousands of fake resumes, and some of them were pretending to be from somebody who hadn't had a job for 6 months, but had relevant experience. And other resumes were from people who hadn't had a job for maybe 1 month, but didn't have any relevant experience. And what this economist found, his name was Rand Gayad, what he found was that employers were more interested in the people who'd had a job recently, even though they didn't, even though the job was irrelevant, and they were turning down people who had useful, relevant experience simply because they'd been unemployed for 6 months, and that was sort of making the they were discriminating against long-term unemployed. When you look at that, you go, well, that's a serious problem, and that needs real attention from the government. And one of the things I discuss in the book is a recent experiment conducted here in England, where the way that the job centre, which basically screens people to see if they're eligible for welfare benefits, unemployment support benefits, they ran an experiment and tried two different ways of advising people and interviewing people and supporting them to try to get back to work. And the new way, which was much more forward-looking, much more kind of almost like life coaching, turned out to be much more successful than the old-fashioned way, which was all about checking that you weren't cheating. So we, you know, these little experiments, they're quite easy to conduct. They don't cost a lot of money to conduct. And when you roll out the results, it could make a real difference to helping people who haven't had a job for a long time get back into the labor market.
We're speaking with Tim Harford. He's an economist, an award-winning journalist, broadcaster, and author. And his latest book is The Undercover Economist Strikes Back on today's Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break, and we'll come back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We're visiting with Tim Harford. His latest book is The Undercover Economist Strikes Back. If you'd like to join in the conversation, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576 is the number. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email, that's radio at WLRN.org. Please keep those emails brief.
And going back to the unemployment, I guess you were sort of joking when you said it was invented by Henry Ford, but what did you mean?
Yeah, so yeah, it's unfair to blame Henry Ford for inventing unemployment, but he did do something that I think tells us a lot about how the modern economy works. So at the time that Ford came up with his management innovation, I'll describe it in a second, the way that the Detroit labor market worked was just like in an economics textbook. So auto workers had jobs, and they were paid a certain wage, and it was easy to get a job, and if you didn't like the manager you were currently working with, you didn't like the company you were working for, or you just fancied a vacation, you'd just not show up. And after 5 days, the company would call you a five-day man, and a five-day man is deemed to have left, to have resigned. And then when you finish with your vacation, you just step back in and you apply for a job with another company and you get that job and you start working again. And so people are just moving in and out of work in this totally frictionless way. Now, that doesn't sound a lot like the modern labor market, and it isn't. And Ford found he had a real problem with turnover. So staff would just be quitting so easily and in such volumes. And he had no problem recruiting staff to replace them, but obviously that's very disruptive. This is where the phrase putting a spanner in the works came from. People would just resort to sabotage. They had no loyalty. He had no commitment. And so what he did, inspired by a visit actually to Manchester in England, where he visited a Ford subsidiary, he raised the wage very significantly, pretty much tripled the wage, and he also reduced the hours that people had to work. So this was suddenly the invention of the $5 day. And the $5 day was a big deal back in about 1914, I think it was, about 100 years ago. And suddenly there were people queuing around the block to get a job at Ford's factory. So this is Detroit in January, so it's cold. And they're being hosed down by the police, they're being hosed down by the fire department, their clothes are freezing, they go home, they get changed, they come back out and they queue some more because they're so desperate to get these jobs. So why did Ford do this? Well, he realized if he did that, he had tremendous loyalty, tremendous commitment. If you got a job at a Ford factory, that was a job you would do anything to hold on to. And he found that that paid for itself, that move paid for itself, and pretty soon other companies were doing the same thing. So that created a situation where you had people who had jobs which were good jobs they valued, and you had other people who couldn't find jobs, even though they were just as good. They were equally good, but they were locked outside the labor market. And that's a much better description of how the labor market works these days. You know, you don't feel indifferent between having a job and not having a job. Jobs are sort of priced at this premium. And the problem with that, of course, is what may be good business practice may be profitable for an individual company offering these jobs that people really want is not necessarily good for the economy as a whole because you have this problem of long-term unemployment. So that's a serious issue. And that's the way the modern world has moved. And there's no obvious solution to it.
Why were they being hosed down by the police and the firemen?
Oh, sorry, not to make it clear. There were so many workers just queuing, just trying to get these jobs, and you know, there'd be the concern about public safety and concern about public order, and people, you know, there'd be fights breaking out in the line. So the police were just trying to disperse the line, really. That was the demand that Ford managed to create overnight, and his management innovation was reported around the world. Made front page news. Now, previously, you just had these jobs that you could take it or leave it. It was more like being a taxi driver. You know, as a taxi driver, you don't care too much about any individual fare. You know, I could pick up this passenger, or I could wait. I could pick up a passenger on the next street. It's not a big deal. That's how workers were treating their jobs, and Ford changed everything.
Tell me, the way you described the vagaries of macroeconomics, is economic forecasting a folly?
I don't think we've ever been able to forecast terribly well. I've been fascinated by both John Maynard Keynes, who we discussed earlier, and Irving Fisher, Irving Fisher was a great American economist. Actually, 100 years ago, he was probably the most famous economist in the world. And when Keynes came to America, the Wall Street Journal introduced him to an American audience as, hey, he's England's Irving Fisher. You know, so Fisher was this huge star, and both of them in the 1920s were active stock market investors. Fisher had national newspaper columns, and he was always on the front pages of the newspapers explaining that stocks were going to do this or stocks were going to do that. And they believed that their tremendous knowledge of economics, and they were very knowledgeable about economics, that knowledge of economics would translate into being able to forecast what would happen to the stock market. And it's a sad story, really, because in 1929, the stock market crashed. In the end, it fell 89%, lost, you know, 9/10 of its value. And Keynes lost money, but he changed. He was a very flexible-minded man. He realized he had made a lot of mistakes, and he changed his investment strategy, and he shifted more to a almost like a Warren Buffett-style strategy we would recognize today of buying and holding shares in companies he really understood. And by the end of his life, in 1946, he had made a massive amount of money for his college in Cambridge University. Fisher, on the other hand, equally good economist, never changed his mind. He just couldn't believe that stock prices weren't going to bounce back. And he kept borrowing money, and he kept investing in the stock market, and he lost everything. He lost absolutely everything. And it's a very sad story, but I think it shows neither of these two men, although they were great economists, neither of them were great economic forecasters. And I'm not sure there's ever been a great economic forecaster because the economy is just too complex. 7 billion human beings, probably 10 billion distinct products and services. We've got ourselves into a situation where people believe that the job of economists is they're like weather forecasters. They're supposed to tell us what's going to happen in the future. I think they should be more like dentists. Keynes himself said economists should be like dentists. You go to a dentist, you don't ask the dentist to forecast what's going to happen to your teeth. You ask the dentist to keep your teeth clean, keep them in good repair, to help you out if there's a problem, and to give you good advice about how to look after your teeth. That's what you want from a dentist. You don't want them to make forecasts. And it should be the same with economists. Economists should be able to give us good advice about how to keep the economy going well, and they should be able to advise us about what to do when the economy goes wrong. But I think to expect them to forecast the future, we just can't do that.
Well, what about a personal financial planner? Do you recommend people use that?
Well, I think as with any sort of professional, if you've got a good one, then you're going to be well served. And if you've got a bad one, then you're not going to be well served. I personally have a financial advisor. I think he's great, but he understands my what I want and what I don't want. I do have a concern with the financial planning industry as a whole, in that it offers us the idea that investments can be controlled when often they can't. You can go online and you can look up how much you should be saving for your pension, and you'll have to type in all these numbers: how old are you, what's your retirement date, what's your salary, how much of your income are you contributing to the pension, and it'll spit out this answer. But what it won't tell you is actually the real thing you need to know is, are you going to get a divorce? Are you going to get sick? These are the things that actually govern whether people have a comfortable retirement or not. These are the big risks, and you can't put them in a spreadsheet. You can't put them in an online calculator.
If the recession or the great financial crisis that we had, if that was Keynesian, does that mean that there should have been, you agree, there should have been government intervention, and do you think the stimulus package worked in the United States?
Well, there was a lot of government intervention. Let's be clear. I mean, the Federal Reserve printed a huge amount of money. Actually, they didn't even need to print it. They could just create it. It's fantastic. So when the chairman of the Federal Reserve looks at her bank statement, it's more like an Excel spreadsheet. She can just type in any number she likes. She can just put extra zeros on. That's what it means to be chairman of the Federal Reserve. Just create as much money as you like. So it's bizarre, but that's the way it is. So central banks, the U.S. Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank in Europe, the Bank of England here in the U.K., they created money, and they spent that money trying to prop up the financial system. And I think that was the right thing to do. So I think the immediate reaction to the crisis was good. Obviously, we missed a lot of stuff coming before the crisis, but at the moment of crisis, I think the authorities did what was needed. So then the debate is, did President Bush spend enough money? Did he cut taxes enough? Did he increase government spending enough? Did President Obama do enough? My take on it is they could have done more, both of them. The stimulus was, on average, effective, but that average hides a huge variation. So there were government programs, like there always are, which were just incredibly ineffective. So the most famous one is probably the Cash for Clunkers program. So the government subsidizing you to buy a new car. There's very little evidence that did anything other than just shift around purchases that were already going to happen. So the federal government subsidized new car purchases for a small number of people who were already planning to buy a new car. They just got it cheaper. That didn't really stimulate the economy at all. But on average, I do think that the stimulus was reasonably effective, and I think the recession would have been even deeper had the government not run a substantial deficit.
We're speaking with Tim Harford. He is an economist, an award-winning journalist, broadcaster, and author. And he is a senior columnist at the Financial Times, where he authors his weekly column, The Undercover Economist. We're talking about his new book, The Undercover Economist Strikes Back. We're going to take another break. Stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and economist Tim Harford. If you'd like to join the discussion, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. First up, we have John. He's in Miami. Hi.
Hi, Hi, how are you? Thank you so much for taking my call.
Go ahead.
First of all, I'd like to say that I agree with a lot of things that have been said so far. But at the same time, I think that the way that economics is being taught today is there's a huge disconnect between reality and what really is. For instance, I think macroeconomics is right on point. But microeconomics today is being taught as this theoretical formula as to when an individual or a small company is going to produce a certain amount of products at a certain price. And I think it's so subjective. I think really microeconomics today is accounting. I think accounting really does a better job in depicting how smaller businesses react to things like taxes, you know, the tax multiplier effect, the governmental multiplier effect. And I think there's just a huge disconnect. I think people really don't understand how microeconomics really works. So I just want to see what you have to say about that.
Okay.
Well, thank you, John. I certainly don't want to disrespect accounting. I'm one of these people who believes that we've got something to learn from all sorts of academic study and non-academic study as well. The world's a very diverse place. You want to keep an open mind to all kinds of different perspectives. But I don't think that I would be quite so quick to write microeconomics off. Let me give you a couple of quick examples at the opposite end of the scale. So on the big picture, my microeconomic thesis supervisor, when I was doing my master's degree, he was into designing auctions, and so I was into auctions as well. And a couple of years after I graduated, he designed an auction for the British government that raised over $30 billion selling mobile phone spectrum licenses, cell phone spectrum licenses. And then over in mainland Europe, a couple of European governments tried the same thing. They didn't employ a top-quality microeconomist to design the auctions. The auctions didn't work very well. They didn't make nearly as much money. So, you know, that's tens of billions of dollars you can credit to just one microeconomist doing his job right. On the small scale, I remember going into a Starbucks once and thinking to myself, you know, in theory, Starbucks are missing an opportunity to have a cheaper drink. All these drinks seem really expensive. They should have a cheaper drink that's just difficult to get. And I was sort of going through this whole, you know, this is a textbook argument. There must be this drink. And then I said to the barista, hey, do you have anything smaller than what's on the menu? And she said, yeah, sure, we have a short cappuccino. And, you know the Starbucks menu starts with a tall cappuccino, but she made me this drink. She had the cup, she had everything, and she charged me less. So I got a drink at Starbucks that was cheaper than anything on the menu. And I started going around Starbucks all over the world. I've been to Starbucks in New Zealand, in Beijing, in London, Washington, D.C., all over the world, asked for the short cappuccino. They always have it, and it's always cheaper. So that's a trivial little thing that can save you money every day if you like short cappuccinos. But that was a prediction from microeconomic theory. So, you know, we can always do better as economists. We can always be asking questions about the world. We can always be looking for new evidence. But I think it's still exciting and relevant. We're still finding new things.
Tell us about the hero of your book, New Zealander, Alban William Phillips, and that Moniac machine.
Yeah, that was incredible.
He is amazing. Yeah, Bill Phillips. I mean, there are so many things we could say about Bill Phillips: the crocodile hunter, gold miner, war hero, accused of spying, adventures in a prisoner of war camp, won medals for bravery, just a remarkable, remarkable man. But I wrote about him partly because of what he tells us about economics and what economists should do and what we should do when we were at our best. And one of the things that Bill did was to realize, in the days before computers were widely accessible, this is in the 1940s, he could build a computer model of an economy, modeling all the flows and taxation and imports and exports and interest rates and, you know, money flows, literally with flows. So this thing looked like a bunch of fish tanks all plumbed together with piping and dams and sluice gates. And he made a hydraulic computer that performed these calculations purely by pumping water around the system. And he demonstrated this. He was failing all his exams at the London School of Economics. He demonstrated this machine to all these great economics professors, and they immediately started arguing about how they were going to get this guy a job. So he was really an amazing engineer and very innovative as an economist. But the thing that really speaks to me about the man, out of all the things he did, was something when he was 14 years old. He got hold of a broken down old pickup truck from a neighbor in New Zealand, and all his neighbors had abandoned it. They said, this thing's never going to work again. And this 14-year-old kid popped open the hood and looked at it and decided he was going to figure out how it worked, and he was going to figure out how to fix it. And he did. And I think the economists of Bill Phillips' generation had that same can-do spirit about the economy. Sometimes modern economists, they just give up on the economy. It's too complicated, it's too hard, it's taken a shock, we just have to wait. We can't do anything about it, maybe it'll get better by itself. And Bill's generation of economists would never have thought like that. They would have always have said, we must be able to understand this, we must be able to figure out how the system works, and when we figured out how it works, we're going to fix it. And that's a spirit that I think modern economists need to rediscover.
And we'll take another caller. This is Damien. He's in Delray Beach. Hi.
Hi. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I have a question for Tim. Tim, I'm actually from the UK, but I live here in South Florida. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the Robin Hood tax, which people are trying to get through in the UK, and whether or not you think that that's a good idea, A, for the UK, and B, globally. And I'll take my answer off here.
Sure. Hi, Damien. So it's a good question. The Robin Hood tax was originally called the Tobin tax, after an economist called James Tobin. And the idea is that every time there's a transaction on financial markets, every time like a share is bought and sold, or other financial products are bought and sold, you just take a very, very small slice. The government takes a tiny, tiny slice of that as a tax. And the Robin Hood tax thing is a sort of a branding exercise. So the idea is that that's taxing the rich and it's giving to the poor. Now, I like that. That sounds nice. We like Robin Hood. I'm skeptical that it will actually successfully take money away from the rich. I'm also slightly skeptical that anybody's going to give it to the poor. So my feeling is that this tax confuses two things. One is, how do we keep the financial system stable? And second is, how do we most effectively redistribute from rich to poor, to the extent that we want to do that? And that's obviously, it's a political dispute. Some people don't want any redistribution. Some people want lots of redistribution. But assuming we want some, what's the best way to do it? And I think the best way to do it is actually is income taxes. That's a really straightforward way to do it. And sales taxes on regular products, because rich people buy a lot more products than poor people do. So with a combination of income taxes and sales taxes, that is just the simplest, most direct way to redistribute income to the extent that you want to do that. The Robin Hood tax, well, that taxes the rapidity of transactions, and I don't think that's not necessarily the same thing at all. After all, you and I also indirectly have investments on the stock market that make us rich. And then this question of financial stability, I think financial stability is clearly a really big issue, and something that's not been looked at enough by economists. I've actually argued that where we really need to look for our lessons is, this is going to sound a bit strange, but we should look to safety engineers. So these are the people who try to make sure that oil rigs don't blow up, the people who try to make sure that nuclear power stations don't melt down. And they really understand unexpected interactions in complex systems. They understand the importance of early warnings. They understand the importance of trying to reduce hazards before they become problems. They understand the importance of whistleblowing, whistleblowers who can tell us that unnecessary risks are being run. And I think that that is the approach that regulators and risk managers should be taking to the financial system. I don't think the Robin Hood tax is the best way to achieve the goals that its proponents have. I mean, redistribution from rich to poor, that sounds great. Financial stability, that sounds great. I'm not sure the Robin Hood tax is an effective way to give us either of those things.
Do you think economists pay enough attention to economic inequalities, both, you know, within a country and between countries?
Well, we're paying a lot of attention now, trying to measure it, trying to quantify it. I mean, economists are just like ordinary people. They've got their own political views as to how much inequality is a problem. There's a really intriguing paradox when it comes to inequality, which is that globally, inequality doesn't seem to be getting any worse. In fact, it may even be getting slightly better. But if you look at any particular economy, it's definitely getting worse. It's getting worse in the United States. It's getting worse in my own country, the United Kingdom. It's getting worse in Canada. It's getting worse in China, in Nigeria. So that seems strange. How could it be not getting worse globally and yet getting worse in every individual country you look at? And the reason is because the poor countries are growing faster than the rich countries. In particular, China and India, Brazil, Indonesia, Nigeria, these are all really big countries. They're all growing faster than the rich countries. And so that's compensating, that's reducing inequality. And then, of course, inside economies, inequality is increasing. And those two effects offset each other. What that means is inequality becomes a more and more of a domestic political issue. We used to hear 15 years ago a lot about anti-globalization protests. People would worry a lot about sweatshop labor in Southeast Asia. We still hear about that sometimes, but not as much. The debate has shifted much more to domestic inequality. And when you look at the numbers, it's understandable why that political change has taken place.
We're speaking with Tim Harford about his latest book, The Undercover Economist Strikes Back, How to Run or Ruin an Economy. One more short break, and we'll be right back with you.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, we resume our conversation with economist Tim Harford. Let's take another call. I've got Hector in Miami. Hi. Hector, you're up.
Hey, I'm here. How you doing, Tim? Thanks for being such an insight on the economy. I would wish to know how would, in a macro approach, would like unemployment from 8 to 10% unemployment, all of a sudden we have a demand, a 10% demand. How would that affect overall the economy?
So, I mean, the macroeconomic approach to that is to say, how is the economy as a whole doing? Do we have enough demand? Where's the demand going to come from? Is it going to come from individual households spending more, borrowing? Is it going to come from the government spending? Is it going to come from exports? You know, are the Chinese going to buy the products? Are the Germans going to buy the products? Who's going to buy the products? So that's your macro perspective. The microeconomic perspective looks much more at the breakdown of what's going on, and a couple of worrying things. So one thing is even as unemployment is falling, and it has been falling in the U.S. for quite a while, the number of jobs being created that's not happening nearly as fast as you would want. And so how can it be that unemployment's falling and yet jobs aren't being created quickly? Well, the answer is there are people who neither have jobs nor are unemployed. In other words, they're on they've left the labor market. They're sick. They've decided to go back to college, try and get a degree. They've retired early. And so we economists, we call this labor market scarring. And it's potentially quite damaging because there are long-term impacts of somebody, say, aged 55 going, I'll never get a job. I've got a bit of a pension. I'll just have to cope and retire at the age of 55. And hopefully I've got enough money to make things work. Rather than somebody at the age of 55 saying, the economy's booming, I'm going to get back in, I'm going to find another job. Because once they've made that decision to leave the labor force and just stop looking for work, it can be really difficult to pull them back in. So that's sort of some explanation of what is a bit of a paradox, I think, in the American labor market.
You spend a long time on hyperinflation. Tell us the story of Brazil and the ghost currency. I found that quite interesting.
This is just a beautiful story, which actually I first heard on American radio. I first heard on This American Life, and I went and did a bit more research on it. Basically, what happened is Brazil in the 1980s just kept having problems with inflation. So we worry if inflation gets to 3 or 4%, that people start to get concerned. Brazil was having inflation of 20-30% a month. That's by the end of the year, your money is not worth very much at all. And the government kept trying to deal with the problem, kept trying to create new currencies. So there was the Cruzeiro, and there was the Cruzeiro, and there was the Cruzado, and then there was the Cruzeiro again, and then the Cruzeiro again. And they just kept introducing these new currencies. Nothing worked. And then this team of economists said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to change people's psychology. And this was where the ghost currency came in. So they said, we're still going to have the same old currency in your wallet. It's going to be the Cruzeiro. But everything is going to be labeled in the supermarkets in this ghost currency. It's going to be called the URV, effectively the unit of real value. And if you want to buy something, you have to look up on a price list how many Cruzeiros to the URV. So every month, a loaf of bread would be more and more expensive in terms of Cruzeiros. And every month in your wallet, you'd have more and more Cruzeiros because your salary would be going up because there was inflation. But every month, the loaf of bread would be one URV, say, or half a URV, and it would never change. The URV was really stable. In fact, it was pegged to the dollar. And so what would happen is, as the months went past, people were still being paid in Cruzeiros, and they were still going to the supermarket checkout, and they were paying in Cruzeiros. But when they looked at the prices of things, all the prices were listed in URVs. And so people used the URV as an anchor of value, just to try and understand, what is stuff worth? What is my salary worth? What is a pint of milk worth? What is a loaf of bread worth? Because you need that to get through life in a modern economy. You need to understand what these things are worth. And then, of course, having done this, despite the fact that this currency had no physical form, there were no URV notes, nothing, people came to understand exactly what the URV was worth, and they came to understand that it was stable. And then, of course, one day the economist said, okay, tomorrow we're going to get rid of the Cruzeiros and everyone's going to use URVs instead. And they called it the real. And Brazil still has the real. And that was it. That was the shift. So it's just a beautiful piece of economic psychology. And it makes the point about money that part of what's really important about money is the psychology of it. We think of it as being convenient and difficult to forge and easy to carry around and easy to make change and all these things. But one of the things that's very important about money, about good money, is that it keeps its value in a predictable way. And you kind of know what a dollar's worth. You know what $10 are worth. You know what $100 are worth. And if what $100 bought kept changing, the dollar wouldn't be very good as money anymore.
Where do you think we stand in the recovery now worldwide? Have we turned the corner? I mean, is it over, or are we still teetering?
You're asking an economist to make a forecast. I think we covered that. We economists are terrible at making forecasts. So the simple answer is I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, that's the honest answer. There are signs of hope, for sure. There are signs of normality, that central banks might actually start being able to raise interest rates again and stop printing money. Governments are getting their deficits down. So there are certain economies that are now growing quite strongly. My own economy, actually, the UK, to my surprise, is growing quite strongly. The thing that concerns me at the moment, most of all, is actually the risk of deflation. And deflation is when inflation actually goes negative and prices start to fall. And you might think that's a good thing. You might think, hey, great, prices are falling. Everything's getting cheaper. But of course, if prices really start to fall, then what happens is people just hold on to their money. They're going to wait. They won't buy this week. They'll buy next week or next year. And then, of course, that can precipitate an economic collapse. Mm. And that's been a situation we've had in Japan really for the last 20 years. Mm. Japan hasn't really grown much for two decades. It's incredible. And deflation's been an important part of that. And you look at it and you go, well, what else has been an important part of it? Well, they had a massive real estate bubble, and then they had a massive banking crisis.
Mm.
Does that sound familiar?
Sounds a little familiar. A little too familiar.
Absolutely. So I'm hoping that deflation doesn't come. I'm an optimist. I think we'll be okay, but I don't think we're quite out of the woods yet.
Well, we want to thank you. Tim Harford is an award-winning journalist and economist, broadcaster and author. He's the senior columnist at the Financial Times, where he authors The Undercover Economist. And his latest book is The Undercover Economist Strikes Back, How to Run or Ruin an Economy. Thank you so much for joining us today, Tim Harford.
Thank you. It's been great.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. Free audio archives and downloads at our website, that's WLRN.org. More information as well, including author and book links, at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program deals with what most people strive to avoid, quitting. But sometimes it's best and more realistic to do just that. We'll speak with the co-author of Mastering the Art of Quitting. And today's calendar, on this day in 1862, 152 years ago, the birth of author Edith Wharton in New York City. She was the first woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for the 1920s, The Age of Innocence. Also Ethan Frome, The House of Mirth, and Glimpses of the Moon. And on this day in 1949, 65 years ago, the birth of comic John Belushi in Chicago. Of Albanian descent, he was an original Saturday Night Live cast member. Of course, he died from a drug overdose in 1982. Cheeburger, cheeburger. One more while we ponder the first person proclaimed an honorary citizen of the United States. Winston Churchill. The death of Winston Churchill 49 years ago in 1965. He succeeded Neville Chamberlain as British Prime Minister in 1940. Our theme music, created and performed by Michael Levine. So we leave with a thought from Churchill, whose mother was the daughter of the American millionaire Leonard Jerome. Quote, "From now on, ending a sentence with a preposition is something up with which I will not put." Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.